Well, it's been okay. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Energy Realities Podcast, episode number 98. Good morning to David Blackman, Stu Turley, Irina Slav, and myself, Tammy Nemeth.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, today and going forward, I'm sad to say that we're going to be without the amazing and brilliant, phenomenal Armando Cavanaugh. Armando has a new commitment that conflicts with the podcast, so we're going to carry on and hopefully we'll do as good a job as Armando has done. I just want to sincerely thank Armando for starting this podcast, being an amazing facilitator, and bringing us all together.
Yes, absolutely. He was the glue that held this all together for a long time. We will miss him.
Yes. Maybe we can have him as a guest later if he has time.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a great idea. Yeah.
Well, this week, as you can see, well, I guess if you're not watching, if you're listening to the podcast, today we're talking about Exxon fighting back. There's been an interesting development in the corporate world. ExxonMobil is suing activist investors to stop the repeated tabling of resolutions or proposals that have been previously defeated. David, why is this a significant move?
Well, it's significant in that, traditionally, all of this is governed by the SEC, Security and Exchange Commission here in the United States, where shareholder resolutions are concerned and how these annual meetings are to be conducted. And in the past, SEC has an appeals process that has been set up and has been accessed by companies like ExxonMobil and others whenever they have this problem arise with activist investors, just every year bringing the same resolution that gets voted down by 85-90% of the vote and bringing it up again next year just to be a nuisance. These are nuisance shareholder proposals, and unfortunately, in this administration, with Joe Biden's appointees now running the SEC, the appeals process has just become a rubber stamp, essentially, for the activist investors. And so ExxonMobil, as it has a right to do, decided to bypass that appeals process at the SEC this time and file a lawsuit directly in federal court, challenging the ability of this these two shareholder groups to bring these resolutions, nuisance resolutions. And so that has all the activist investors in a big tizzy, as you can imagine. They're really good at getting themselves into tizzies. Whether ExxonMobil will win the lawsuit, I don't know. Their annual meeting is in April, I think. So there's a couple of months until probably, we'll get a decision at some point between now and then in the district court. And the problem there, of course, then becomes that whoever loses the district court decision then, of course, has the right to appeal to the appellate court level and could end up taking this all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which would take years to reach a final resolution in our court system. So it's an interesting move by ExxonMobil. They certainly have the right to do it. But that doesn't necessarily mean they have a right to win it. And we'll just see how it all comes out. It's just a really interesting glitch in the process here caused by, frankly, the biasing of the process. I was going to say corruption of the process at the SEC by this administration, as we've seen them do in so many other aspects of the government. So I'm rooting for Exxon. I don't know about anybody else.
Irina, do you think this is something other companies elsewhere might do, like in Europe?
If they've had enough, yes. After all, Total Energies is suing Greenpeace for wrong data. I think the French led the way there because they just had enough. I see these activist investors and environmental groups in the case of Total Energies as school bullies that have never met a worthy opponent. So they're used to having their way. And they don't even consider the possibility that someone might do something about it. And I think this is precisely the case here because I was very, very amused by the reactions to this lawsuit, and more specifically, the fact that even after those two activist investors dropped their proposal, Exxon didn't drop the lawsuit. It said it will pursue it. And we had the Norway Sovereign Wealth Fund, which is popularly known as the Norway Oil Fund. So its head called the lawsuit aggressive and a move that will undermine shareholder trust in Exxon or something like this, because it undermines shareholder rights. Oh, really? So shareholders have rights. Do companies have rights to defend their strategy? Apparently they do, hence the lawsuit. And then there was a group of religious investors in Exxon, and that group called on the company to, you know, pull the lawsuit out because it's not nice to investors. Guess who's a member of this group of religious investors? Arjuna Capital, one of the activist investors that is being sued. So totally unbiased, totally, you know, independent call for Exxon to let go, but it's not going to do this. And like David, I'm rooting for the company, even though I'm not a fan of big oil or any big business, because you know the larger corporations grow, the more inhumane they become, which is a normal process, I expect.
Yeah,
and they're certainly not weak and vulnerable, and you know poor old Exxon or anyone else. But I think they're in the right this time. They have the right to, you know, make their case and stop succumbing to activist pressure. What do you think?
Yes, because, yeah, it's like they're abusing the system, right? The system was set up in order to ensure that there was fairness there, but they're abusing it, as at least from my perspective. Stu, do you see this as a positive action for Exxon? Do you think this is something that would be good?
I got all choked up there for a moment. I do. Yes, absolutely. I think that there's a couple things. Irina, I loved your comment. I don't like big oil because there's probably bad things going on. However you phrased it.
I don't like really big good. Anything.
Yeah, thank you. So, but the oil companies have not done a great job in articulating the goodness that they have done in the past. And I couldn't be more proud of the fact that the elevation of humanity out of poverty is because of low cost fossil fuels getting it there. Now, we have been improving how to not have such a big impact on the environment over all these years. Are we there yet? Heck no. Do we have a long way to go? Absolutely. Do we need, how many billions of people need low cost, sustainable, energy? A lot. I'm a humanitarian first and a huge environmental fan. So that we got to protect the environment. Now we have to defend ourselves against chowderheads. So I think that we should have a GoFundMe page for this podcast to defend against chowderheads. I think that's a great idea.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea. Absolutely. Absolutely. You don't want to charge membership on YouTube because YouTube steals 30% off the top when people become paying customers on YouTube. And if they do it with an Apple iPhone, Apple takes 30% before YouTube takes its 30%. So you end up with less than half.
And that is why I don't like big business.
Yes, exactly. Oh. Talk about big business. There they are.
Irina, I knew I liked you. Holy smokes.
One last point about this, and Irina brought it up. You know, the shareholders, the activist investors dropped their proposals.
Very quickly.
Right, very quickly after Exxon filed suit, anticipating that Exxon would pull the lawsuit. But Exxon didn't pull the lawsuit. And that's very important because part of what I think Exxon is doing is showing that there's going to be a penalty to be paid in terms of lawyers' fees. Because now these investor groups are going to have to spend a lot of money defending themselves in that lawsuit. And, you know, that's something they wouldn't necessarily have had to do had they gone up through the SEC. So there's a punitive portion of this, and I think it's important for people to understand that the court system and the laws in the United States are set up to protect not just the rights of the activist groups and the people on the political left, but to protect every person's and every entity's rights in our process. And that's an important principle, I think. And I'm really glad Exxon is going to see this all the way through because of that aspect of it. You know, whatever you think about Exxon and other big corporations, they have a right to conduct their business in this country as long as they do it within the letter and the spirit of the laws and regulations that they operate under. And this, you know, nuisance activist investor, these two activist investor groups were just trying to game the system in order to waste their time and their money and diminish the value of the company to the rest of the shareholders in it. And so I just think it's an important legal principle for ExxonMobil to pursue, and I'm glad they're doing it.
Absolutely. It's a case of rules for thee, but not for me. Yeah. This is what the activist investors and the environmentalists are thinking. They can do absolutely anything they want. They can sue anyone. They can, you know, be a nuisance to companies with such proposals. But, you know, the enemy cannot react.
Right.
That's not supposed to happen. Well, now
yeah, they're not allowed to. Reacted. Yeah.
Yeah, they're not allowed to. It's not polite or whatever.
Right.
But it's happening, and that's a good thing.
It is a good thing.
Yeah, and I really hope that the Exxon lawsuit is an inspiration to other companies to maybe do the same thing. And even if it's not just with respect to the shareholder motions, which are important, but a lot of the climate groups have taken this new strategy where they use the advertising bureaus or competition bureaus in order to do what's really quite malicious litigation in a way through the regulatory system. And that's been the case in the UK, the EU, and now Canada, where I think in the last year, there's been at least six complaints made to the Competition Bureau over supposed false advertising or misleading advertising, because the oil and gas companies in Canada, when they're doing advertisements to say, we're working towards net zero and this is what we're doing, the activists are saying they're greenwashing, that they're lying, they're misleading the public because they're not explaining what percentage of their operations is in the transition and what percentage is still their traditional business. So when they do those complaints, the companies end up having to spend a lot of money on lawyers and whatnot in order to respond to the questions that are put forward by the competition bureaus. And they did this in the UK, I think, a couple of years ago, and they managed to go after and won against Shell, BP, Repsol, and maybe Total, where they were told that they were misleading the public because they weren't explaining precisely what percentage of their operations are climate related. And, you know, even though they're talking facts, the facts apparently are misleading.
There was a recent case in the UK, the advertising whatever authority banned, it started with Equinor, I think, and now it's banned a couple of other oil companies from advertising anything really, because they're not saying that while they're doing, for example, wind, they're also doing oil and gas, and that's apparently misleading and greenwashing.
Right, exactly. That was the determination. So you get activists in putting forward the complaints, and you have activists in the regulatory bodies, and so then they just kind of support each other, which is why, right, you know, I think it's could be a problem in the United States, depending on what jurisdiction the court proceedings take place. You know, you get the wrong judge or something like that, and it can be an issue these days. And now there's a new group that's going around educating judges on climate issues. So
sorry.
There's an environmental group that helps educate judges on climate issues.
Is it voluntary or is it mandatory?
It's voluntary right now, but recommended through the various bar associations.
Of course. Yeah. The bar associations have been completely taken over and corrupted by the DEI crowd.
In the words of my wife, it's voluntold.
Voluntold commanded. Yes.
Voluntold commanded.
Well, I thought maybe we could move on to the headlines, unless does someone want to add a little more about that Exxon issue?
I've got nothing.
We're all rooting for Exxon.
So that was David's main headline today.
We just covered that.
So, right. And so the next one, David, do you want to tell us why the low rig count is important?
Yeah, this was interesting aspect. You know, the Baker Hughes rig count, of course, has been the one that most people rely on. I also like to keep up with the Enverus rig count. They do a daily rig count update, but they basically mirrored one another over the past few years. Over the last 2 weeks, the Baker Hughes count fell below 500. It's a count of active drilling rigs in the United States. For only the fourth time in the last 27 years, this count fell below 500 here in the United States. And it was interesting to me that happened at a time when our industry here in the U.S. continues to set new record highs for overall oil production and natural gas production each month, almost on a monthly basis. So I went back and did a little research, and the previous three times the count has dropped below 500 in the U.S., we have been in the midst of a major price bust and a depression in the industry. In 1999, we were in a major price depression. Oil fell below $20 due to a struggling global economy that had cut into demand globally. And then in, I think, 2006, it fell below 500 again, and we were in a major price drop. And then in 2016, it dropped way down. Or no, 2020, it dropped to 275 in September of 2020 during the COVID bust. And of course, we were in, you know, I mean, in that year, we even had negative pricing for WTI. So it's fascinating to me that trend in the industry that has been pretty much unshakable over the years has now been broken. And it's because, of course, these companies in the shale sector in the United States have deployed new technologies and processes and become, you know, much, much more accurate in identifying the sweet parts of the underground rock formations that they're accessing and staging their frac jobs and all that. And it has dramatically increased the per well recoveries in the Permian Basin, DJ, Bakken Shale, Marcellus, Haynesville, all the big shale plays in the United States. And so we continue to set these new records, even while the rig count is very low. And that's just a new thing in our industry. And so what it really means is, where the active rig count was always kind of a key indicator of the health of the oil and gas industry in the U.S., those days are gone. You can't just look at the rig count and determine, you know, what else might be happening in terms of price and global demand for the commodity. And that's just an interesting development. I thought it was worth mentioning here.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
Yeah, that's how everyone got surprised by last year's production growth rate, because the rig count wasn't rising for much of the year. And then suddenly it's plus a million or so. Even the Energy Information Administration was, you know, misled.
Well, and I think it caught everyone off guard. EIA at the first of last year predicted U.S. total oil production would rise by maybe 300,000 barrels a day during 2023. And like you said, it went up by almost a million barrels a day during the year. So really amazing.
Yeah. That's amazing that they could do that, such efficiency, that there's been those significant changes in how they operate, that they can reduce the number of rigs.
Yeah. Okay. You know, a lot of it has to do with the length of the horizontals. You know, they're drilling three mile horizontals now in some of these wells. It's crazy. Gas companies were burned by excess investments before. Not positive what that's referring to. Certainly in the early stage of the shale boom in the United States, gas companies were investing, you know, very, very heavily in drilling programs. We had a 2000 rig count in the U.S. in 2014 before Saudi Arabia flooded the market with oil to bust the price, and that ended that. But the industry took a lot of criticism for investing too heavily in drilling programs back during that time.
Okay, the next headline. This is mine. Okay, so this is kind of related to some of the stuff we've been talking about. This is a case that was brought against the Norwegian government and Equinor, because Equinor is the company that drills on these in these areas offshore in Norway. And so a couple of activist groups sued the Norwegian government and Equinor. And the activists won a challenge in a lower court that if they actually carry out the ruling, Equinor would have to take future climate change effects into account in applying to drill offshore. And so what they mean by future climate change effects is the use of their products. So it's like scope 3 emissions. The company would have to take into account
emissions.
Right. I mean, it's outrageous. And when you think about it, what including scope 3 emissions means is that you're actually saying, I will reduce the amount of my product on the market. That's what accounting for scope 3 means, is that you reduce what you're producing, because how on earth are you going to tell your consumer you can't use as much of this product that I'm selling you? It's bizarre. So they won this case. The Norwegian government says they're appealing it. And of course, the environmental groups are like, oh, this is so bad. Why are you appealing this? It's bad for the earth, blah, blah, blah. And I what I think is so interesting is that it doesn't really matter in some respects that the ruling is being appealed. Who knows how long that process takes. But I believe it's going to be used as a precedent for other jurisdictions to say, oh, well, this court ruled this, and we think that we should maybe apply some of those principles in our jurisdiction. And I think Canada is probably going to be one of those. So that's that story that just came out, I think, a couple weeks ago. And then
that's a big deal.
It is a big deal. And what's so fascinating is that here's Norway, that and the Norwegian government position was that the EU needs their natural gas and they need its oil. And so to carry out what the court has said, then they will be jeopardizing energy security in the EU. So it's interesting that the climate is now competing with energy security for the attention of policymakers, and maybe that's a good thing.
And the EU is not saying anything against Equinor and their new drilling for gas.
Right, because they need it, right?
Yeah, funny thing.
Yeah, so I think somebody said here, buy more offsets. Well, okay, but the problem is when you're filing that application to be able to do exploration and development on that piece of land, what this ruling says is that you have to look at the larger climate effect without offsets. So even if you wanted to buy offsets, it wouldn't be.
It's not enough if you're an oil company, apparently.
Right.
Does Taylor Swift have to do that with her private jet?
Oh, she sold 3 of her 5, or I think.
Oh, did she? Okay, cool. Yeah, that's great.
Maybe she sold really downsizing.
Yeah, I got one of them.
And the next headline was about using competition law, which is what I mentioned in the discussion of Exxon. And as I mentioned, in Canada, there's been at least 6 cases brought to the Competition Bureau about false advertising or misleading advertising. And one of the big ones that was, I think, launched last fall was the Pathways Alliance, which is Canada's biggest oil sands companies, formed this Pathways Alliance in order to work together to have technological innovation to reduce emissions to net zero by 2050. And so nobody knew what that they were actually doing anything. And they thought, well, okay, we'll put out some ads and tell people, this is these are the steps that we're taking in order to get to net zero the way the government wants us to. So the environmental groups immediately launched a competition complaint. And it's really easy to do it in Canada. You need six people to make some accusation that they were felt misled or something. And then it triggers this review. So the environmental group said, oh my gosh, this is misleading. They're not taking into account the emissions of the people who use their product. So it's the same argument that was used in Norway, that the Pathways Alliance are misleading people by not providing that information to the public in their advertisements about their net zero plans. So, and then what I found so interesting about the use of the litigation and use of these regulations and so on, especially with respect to advertising, is that last week, the socialist MP in Canada that helps prop up the current government in a coalition, as Brian Zinchuk here is saying, he said, don't forget the NDP wants to make it illegal to advertise in favor of oil and gas in Canada. I think he meant oil. It's a typo. So this bill, which is absolutely something straight out of the Soviet Union, where it would be illegal to speak the truth. So if a company or somebody wanted to write a story about the things that oil sands companies are doing or natural gas companies are doing, that it's a benefit to the environment or to the economy even, that the indigenous people are participating and it helps in reconciliation, that would be illegal. And you'd be fined anywhere from $500,000 to $1 million with 2 years in jail. I mean, it's crazy. And so they're trying to say, oh, we only meant corporate leaders. Can't talk about that. But if you read the bill, that's not what it says. So, yeah. So
I mean, it would make it illegal for Chevron to run its ads bragging about the gas additive Tecron that it puts in its gasoline. You know, you wouldn't even be able to advertise that as a selling point for your product. It's insane.
Yeah.
Oh, what about Tony the Tiger? You know, put a tiger in your tank. Where's PETA when you need it?
Tony the Tiger went extinct. Yeah.
Because they like one of the arguments is that they want to treat it like the tobacco companies. And so in Canada, it's illegal for tobacco firms to advertise. And they passed this a long time ago, went to the Supreme Court, and eventually they won. And they said this is the tobacco moment for oil and gas. Yeah. So if you had something like Tony the Tiger, that would immediately be like, oh my gosh, you're trying to poison the minds of the youth. So,
I'd like to see somebody, if this is the tobacco moment for the oil and gas industry, I'd like to see somebody smoke some gas.
No, that'd be a little explosive.
Interestingly, some of the all of the vaping liquids that are replacing tobacco products contain propylene glycol, which is a petrochemical product.
Oh gosh,
I'm too old, Irina. I don't know anything like that.
Mihai has a comment here. He said, "Nothing of value is lost. There's no need to advertise the path to net zero. Just deliver cheap energy." You know, in a rational world, that would make complete sense. But if you understood the politicization of the energy conversation in Canada, the oil and gas companies need to advertise to explain to people, because all anybody hears is how terrible they are, that the oil and gas companies are poisoning the world and they're killing people and all this kind of stuff. And so why shouldn't they have an opportunity to advertise what it is that they're actually doing instead of these other sort of amplifiers out there of the negatives? So
it's an information war.
It is an information war.
Only one side is being heard, and the other side is being blacked out.
Yeah, and they want to keep it that way.
Why does this sound familiar anyway?
Which is, I mean, that's what's so important about the Exxon case, right? Because it's finally this little thin, oh, maybe we should push back a little bit. And
yeah, maybe you should push back a lot.
Okay.
No, really.
So Irina, I think this is,
that's one of mine. And this is the example why the energy industry should push back, because shifting climate scenarios muddy the picture for investors. It's a misleading headline from Bloomberg. And basically, the story is about banks that have to adjust their net zero targets and plans, because guess what? The forecasts on which these plans were based did not come true. And the story mentions specifically, guess what? The IEA's roadmap to net zero from 2021, from May 2021, the document, the first of its kind, in which the International Energy Agency said that we can get to net zero by 2050 and we can stop investing in new oil and gas exploration as of 2021. If you remember,
later
in November, in its monthly oil market report, that same International Energy Agency, I will never tire of repeating this, called on oil companies to invest in more oil and gas production because there was a shortage on the horizon. But this is not the only thing they were wrong about. Because, as banks tell Bloomberg, and I'm reading from the story here, for example, the forecast for coal demand in 2030 was increased by 32% in the 2023 scenario. That's an update on the original document. So what we have is what we already know the IEA is doing. It makes insane forecasts about demand, including its recent forecast that oil, gas, and coal demand will all peak before 2030. Then, a couple of years later, it has to go back on this forecast because reality is proving that it's insane. But in the meantime, banks of all people, not that they're people, but banks of all industries, have bought the original forecast and think it is actually reflecting reality. And they make their, you know, their targets and their plans in accordance with that deranged sort of, you know, not even forecasting, it's wishful thinking. This is what banks are doing. Banks are basing their strategies, their investment strategies, their funding strategies on wishful thinking. And now this is starting to crack, which is great. Muddy the picture. Yeah, right.
How is it that you know, the people that run these big banks are smart people, right? How have they not figured out yet
that the IEA
is a completely politically motivated bunch of hacks?
I think they just buy it. They believe it. Then some make the effort of, you know, researching it, I think. But not enough.
It's just mind-boggling.
The thing with the scenario analyses, like you mentioned, I mean, the banks are trying to get the companies to use the same ones, and they want to mandate it. And so, for example, in Canada, they had a call just before Christmas to have input on a scenario analysis that will be done by the Office of the Superintendent for Financial Institutions. It will mandate every financial institution that's federally regulated in Canada to use the one that they make. And the one that they make will be based on the IEA scenario analyses.
Oh, my God.
And so can you imagine? You know, what's funny is that insurance companies have their own. They have their own risk analyses. They have their own scenario analyses. They pay really smart companies to come up with them. But now, of course, in this whole centralization move, is that they want one for everybody to use. Are you telling me that Bank of America uses the same scenario analyses that JP Morgan does? I don't think so. They probably have their own in-house things. But now they want to make it all the same. And what's interesting, like with the sustainability standards, they require companies to have to update their scenario analysis every 2 years. So are the banks now saying, we don't need to update. We're just going to use this one for how long? I mean, the thing with scenario analyses, Arena, as you point out, is like they're predictions, and a lot of them are based on really bad assumptions, really hopeful, wishful assumptions.
Exactly.
Right? So then it's like, why are you mandating the use of faulty and bad information? It seems to want to put the banks into a terrible state if they base their decisions on this inappropriate information.
Yeah. Wow.
Okay, Arena, is this the next one?
Big European fund sells 2.8 billion euro in oil holdings because of slow moves on climate. Now, that news story comes from the Netherlands, where they're crazy about the transition, but not all of them, as we've seen. Their farmers are fine, and the people who support their farmers are just fine. But this pension fund, which has about 240 billion euro in assets, has sold its holdings in Shell, BP, and Total Energies because, and I quote, they were not doing enough to produce credible plans for the clean energy transition. Translated, this means that these three super majors are not, they have not pledged to commit suicide. So apparently that's why it has divested from them. I wondered, might this divestment have anything to do with the recently very strong financial results of the super majors? Yeah. Might it have something to do that, assuming this fund, I haven't looked at its holdings, but assuming this fund has holdings in Ørsted, for example, or Vestas, or I don't know, Siemens Energy, it has a hole to fill? I'm just speculating here, but this is a big move and it's a stupid move because this is a pension fund. This is a fund where people, workers, put their pension money.
Yeah.
And yeah. With that move, which is virtue signaling of the highest order, they are potentially depriving their clients of bigger, I'm not sure how, but yeah, I'm sure actually. They are depriving them of bigger pension checks or whatever down the line. Because imagine this, if they're divesting from three big oil majors, they still have seven listed oil companies in their portfolio because apparently those seven listed companies have credible plans. But if they pull out of big oil and go in more significantly into so-called alternatives, their clients are going to be in trouble before too long.
Yeah.
They just don't know about it. Because the climate narrative trumps everything else, such as, the security of investment returns, which so many investors have seen that the returns from so-called green funds have nothing on returns from oil funds.
So, Irina, would you say then that maybe these institutional investors and other ones like those ones that seem to be really inordinately influenced by green activists, do you think they're maybe like a threat to energy security?
I think they're a threat to people's retirement money security.
Yeah, good point.
I don't know about energy security because luckily, the oil companies still have a lot of other institutional and other shareholders to keep them going. But if I were a client of this fund, I would have pulled my money out of it. Definitely.
Mihai thing says maybe they plan to go big on nuclear and that's why they divested.
Yeah, maybe. I'm just not sure. I don't think they're thinking clearly. They're thinking green.
Yeah, short-sightedly green.
Very, very short-sighted.
All right, Stu, these are your headlines? What's happening between India and Russia?
I'll tell you what. I'd like to thank our staff for finding Bill Murray and imitating that he was out there in... looks like
he was... looks like Bill Murray.
I don't know how they found a guy that looks like Bill Murray's long lost twin brother. I want to give a shout out to Ruben here. Hey, Ruben, thank you. His is thank God for education based content like this, which explains what oil and gas companies are really doing. Maybe more education dollars versus advertising dollars will tip the scales. Ruben, I'm not sure what you're smoking, but I sure appreciate it.
Yeah, I sure wish the oil and gas companies would support what we're doing here. But anyway, that's another topic. Yes.
Well, I think we'll go back into that here in a sec. But I think that when you take a look at Bill Murray standing there, I'm just blown away by that. Indian Oil has a contract with Rosenfelt from 2020, which the refiner was to import 2 million tons of Urals grade crude. The deal was extended in 2023. And last year, Russia exported an average of 1.75 million barrels of crude of India per day. So India is the third largest importer of crude. And we also had Novatek reporting, I believe this morning, that EBITDA 1.37 trillion rubles, or 15.05 billion in net cash. That's not bad. So sanctions don't work as intended, this great lady Irina Slav has always been saying. Take a look at India, and India and Russia have been bonding together, selling in rubles. David and I have talked about this a lot, that the U.S. dollar U.S. petrodollar is going away. And then you take a look at ExxonMobil and their shuttle tanker new builds, the amount of tankers that are being ordered around the world. The shuttle tankers are becoming more and more important because of how the Jones Act and having to get things offloaded around in there. So that's survival that Exxon is having to do. So
where's that Exxon Mobil tanker story? Where's that clip from? What publication?
I'll have to go look, find it.
Okay, I'll find it.
Okay. So
I think I have it, but go ahead.
When we take a look at what was my point besides Bill Murray? Sorry. It is Monday morning, guys, and I am still tired.
So I noticed in that shuttle article, though, they were talking about with the destination for them, that it wasn't just for, say, the Gulf of Mexico or whatever, but for Guyana.
Oh, yes.
For their actions and for their drilling around Guyana.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And Exxon is, and I thought that was interesting on the Guyana, Venezuela issue, is that all the reports that were coming in from Exxon and Chevron saying we're not going anywhere. So no matter what was going on, basically what I took from all of those articles that I was reading over the weekend, Tammy, was the fact that Exxon and Chevron were saying, no matter who wins, the poor Guyanese, is that how you say it? Guyanese? Guyanans?
Guyanese, you're right.
Okay, wow. Are basically being thrown out with the bathwater again. And this is so sad because the big oil is going to stand there and say, I don't care who's paying the bill. And so I think that insurance is the big reason these smaller tankers are going to be shuttling. So I think insurance companies are going to be the one. I can't remember where we talked about that before, but.
Very interesting. Very interesting.
There it is.
That's a link to the.
Yeah, I found it. Thank you. Yeah.
Okay. Cool. Awesome.
That's a good story.
So
that's a good story.
I think what a fascinating element of the increased trade between India and Russia that's included in that Bloomberg article was that India's oil trade has increased from 0.2% of imports in India to 30 to 34% since the Ukraine invasion in 2022. So it's not like it's just a small increase in the oil trade between India and Russia. It's actually pretty big.
Yeah, and then Russia's economy is surprisingly resilient. Really? If these people are genuinely surprised, they need to be fired, seriously.
Well, I mean, is it the same people coming up with those scenario analysis?
It might well be the case. You know?
Might well be, yes.
Very, very, very likely.
Hey, I've got another story that's just breaking if we're done there.
Sure.
You bet.
Diamondback Energy, big Permian independent producer, is entering into a $26 billion cash and stock deal for privately held Endeavor Energy Partners, one of the most active drilling companies in the Permian Basin over the past few years. $26 billion acquisition for Diamondback continues the rapid consolidation of the Permian Basin. Anyway, I just thought that was interesting.
Starting to sound a bit like Highlander. I'm sorry, I don't know why I had this thought when I read the news. Eventually.
Look at that. You're so quick, Stu.
I don't know about being quick.
This will mean Diamondback, once this deal is consolidated, is going to be producing 865,000 barrels of oil by themselves out of the Permian Basin in the United States. 15 years ago, that's more than was being produced across the entire Permian Basin. Okay.
Wow.
Now, one producer, well, in ExxonMobil, once they finish the Pioneer deal, is going to be producing 1.13 million barrels of oil per day. Just ExxonMobil.
Brian, you're a hoot. Thank you so much.
We'll take the advertising anyway. Anything for a buck.
Actually, if it's a Canadian company, even if they're advertising outside the country, it would be illegal or something. I don't know.
Of course.
I would absolutely love to thank all of the folks that are commenting. And yes. I would also like to give a shout out to Armando again. And he was the one running all of this. So Tammy and I are playing a war or battleship back here with the comments. So any comments that you all make, please give us feedback. Reach out to us. We want to hear from all of the listeners. We've gotten great feedback on all this. And Tammy, please, push me out of the way, please.
Thank you, Ruben, for that kind comment. That's nice. Thank you.
So Ruben writes here, for people who are listening on audio and not video, Ruben writes, he's out checking leases, listening to the show. Thanks for the shout out. Thanks for being a voice of reason that supports our industry.
Thank you.
Thank you for all the work you're doing in the industry.
Well, do you guys have anything else you want to add today, or should we wrap it up?
Let's wrap. Start preparing.
We have covered the landscape today, haven't we? This has been great. This has been wonderful. We miss you, Armando. Wish you all the best in the future. And, it won't be the same without you, but we're going to keep plugging along.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing us together.
Thank you, Tammy, for doing a great job today. Appreciate it.
Thank you. When do you get to do it next week?
I vote for Arena.
It's your turn next week. All right, have a great week, everyone.
Bye,
everybody.